From California to Michigan, Alaska to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the left is using the courts to slow the Trump agenda, filing a slew of lawsuits in friendly venues. Michael O'Neill of the Landmark Legal Foundation is here with a look at where those suits stand. The U.S. Senate has taken a major step in the reconciliation process that would preserve and expand the Trump tax cuts. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. That Senate budget resolution, however, would add to the national debt. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Romina Boccia of the Cato Institute. And President Trump's trade policies are creating an uproar, but they're also causing a political realignment. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The left is using lawfare, the filing of lawsuits in progressive-friendly courts, in an effort to slow or stop implementation of a wide range of executive orders signed by President Donald Trump. For a look at where the key cases stand, we turn to Michael O'Neill. He is vice president of the Landmark Legal Foundation. Michael, welcome to American Radio Journal. Michael, the Supreme Court of the United States has weighed in on a couple of the lawfare cases that have been filed against Trump administration executive orders and actions. Can you bring us up to date on what the Supreme Court has ruled on this past week?
Earlier this week, the court vacated a temporary restraining order issued by a district court judge in Washington, D.C. that had essentially tried to put a halt to the removal of the individuals part of the Tren de Aragua narco-terrorism organization. These are individuals who had come into the United States, entered into the United States at the behest of the Venezuelan government. They had connections to the Venezuelan government and essentially were functioning as narco-terrorists. They posed a national security, clear and present danger to the American people. These weren't your run-of-the-mill gang members. These were individuals who were really participating in the worst of the worst activities. Human trafficking, fentanyl distribution, murder, rape, essentially a parade of horribles. Again, above and beyond your typical gang activity, they were essentially engaging in narco-terrorist activities. And so what the president did is he utilized his power under the Alien Enemies Act to identify, detain, and remove these individuals in a national security operation. It's really important to look at this case through that lens, not a criminal operation. This is essentially a national security operation. Well, what had happened was, of course, a lawsuit had been brought in the district court in Washington, D.C., and that district court judge had stopped the action, essentially inserted himself into a national security operation. And probably you remember, your listeners will remember, that this is where the judge said, turn the planes around. These are individuals who are being sent to prisons in El Salvador. And the judge had said, stop the planes, stop the operation. I'm going to put a halt on it. Well, the Supreme Court spoke on this earlier this week and vacated that temporary restraining order and said, look, if any kind of challenges are going to be made to this, these challenges have to be made in Texas or Louisiana. Again, these are the venues that have the individuals where the individuals are being detained. It's not proper to bring a challenge in Washington, D.C. You have to bring this in the context of a habeas proceeding in either Texas or Louisiana on an individualized basis, not on this massive class basis. So what you saw here is the court affirming, saying essentially that, number one, a district court in Washington, D.C. doesn't have jurisdiction to hear these cases. If you're going to hear these cases, they have to be brought on an individualized basis down in courts in Texas and Louisiana.
It does seem when these cases are filed, Michael, that there's a lot of venue shopping going on. They usually try to file a case like in Washington, D.C. or someplace where they're going to get a favorable ruling.
Absolutely. These are, again, the individuals who are challenging this, who are essentially waging this kind of lawfare on virtually every executive action that the president has taken since taking office, are sophisticated and smart parties. These are smart, well-heeled lawyers who know exactly what they're doing. They know that they should initiate these lawsuits and file these lawsuits in venues and jurisdictions that are going to have judges that are more amenable to their particular arguments. And that, of course, encompasses Washington, D.C., New York. You could pretty much predict where these cases are going to go. I'm sure your listeners would be well-versed in the sort of jurisdictions that would be more amenable to those opposing the president. And what's interesting here is now, of course, these individuals here are going to be, with the Trendaragua cases, these are going to be heard down in Texas and Louisiana. Those are district courts that are probably going to be more amenable to the president and his efforts to essentially protect the American people and address this clear national security threat. And, of course, the appellate jurisdiction that has authority over those courts is the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is known in lawyers and in law circles as probably the most conservative of the existing federal appellate jurisdictions in the country.
The Supreme Court also weighed in on another case. Can you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, this was a brief, very brief ruling. This is, if you actually look at it, the order is only about five lines long. This is regarding President Trump's efforts to terminate the employment of probationary employees in one of the government agencies. Here, I think it was about 11,000 of these individuals. And so a lawsuit, of course, was brought in this case seeking to enjoin or stop the termination of these individuals. Interestingly, the lawsuit was brought by a national NGO, a non-governmental organization, a nonprofit organization, and the court dispensed with this on a technicality, simply said that the NGOs that brought these lawsuits that were representing these individuals didn't have standing to bring it. In other words, they didn't demonstrate a cognizable injury in fact. They couldn't satisfy that necessary standing requirement in order to continue on a lawsuit. So the court kicked that out and said, look, the institutions, the entities that are bringing this lawsuit on behalf of these government employees don't have the standing, don't satisfy the standing requirement. We're going to kick this lawsuit out. You're going to have to satisfy standing before you can do this. But broadly speaking, this is part of an effort, and I think you're going to see this going forward, is the president trying to assert authority over the executive branch employees. And this is something that's probably going to migrate up to the Supreme Court, the extent to which the president has the authority to terminate employment of individuals who are employed within the executive branch. This is kind of an offshoot of that unified executive theory that we've talked about. And I think the court's probably lurching towards the way where they're going to defer to the presidential authority to manage his own affairs within his own government agency.
This seems to be handing some judicial wins to the Department of Government Efficiency and Elon Musk's efforts as well, doesn't it?
I think so. I think you're seeing when some of these cases actually get up to the Supreme Court on these expedited emergency basis, the court's kind of leaning towards, hey, look, we're going to defer to the separation of powers. We're going to restore, understand that judges have a lane they have to stay in, Congress has a lane it has to stay in, and President Trump has a lane that he has to stay in, and we're going to ensure that the separation of powers continues. I think what another case, and you see these lawsuits about DOGE sharing data, I think that's another case that's a loser for those challenging Donald Trump's agenda. You're going to try to say that DOGE can't have access to IRS data or Social Security data. This is government agencies, government entities sharing data amongst themselves to do what? Well, to increase efficiencies and to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. And I think that's kind of a managerial aspect of how the president is supposed to manage the executive departments and all of the agencies under his auspices.
In addition to attempting to cut down the size of the federal bureaucracy, another major thrust of Trump executive orders has been this issue of non-citizens who have been protesting on college campuses, inciting violence. Those cases still to be adjudicated?
Yeah, still to be adjudicated. I think what we're talking about here is the simple fact that entering into America and studying on a college campus is a privilege and not a right. And that you can have your student visas revoked if you're going to come into this country and you're going to work to destroy the country, you have to play by our rules. And if you're going to engage in quasi-violent protests and intimidation and what's going on in some of these college campuses, you shouldn't be surprised to have your visa that's going to be your student visa be revoked. This is, again, a privilege. You come here at the beset and at the privilege and at the honor of the United States of America. You don't get to come into our country and essentially create havoc and undermine our values. If you're going to come into the country, you have to play by our rules and you have to follow the conditions set by your visa. And if you violate those conditions, you're going to have that visa revoked and you're going to get kicked out.
Michael O'Neill is Vice President of Legal Affairs at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Michael, tell us a bit about Landmark Legal Foundation. Also, a lot of cases, we only had time to talk about a couple of them. There are many. Where can folks track all this on the web?
Yeah, you can go to our website, landmarklegal.org. We have a lot of information up on all of these issues on our website. Landmark Legal Foundation is a national public interest law firm. We have offices in Kansas City, and we have offices outside of Washington, D.C. We promote liberty, and we combat tyranny. We promote separation of powers and constitutional government.
Michael O'Neill of the Landmark Legal Foundation. Michael, thank you so much for taking time to be here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on Congress, where there has been substantial movement toward getting us to the point where we get one big, beautiful bill. But there's a lot of maneuvering that's going to go on before we get there. Scott Parkinson's going to explain it all. Scott, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back.
The United States Senate last week moved the ball forward a bit here with a resolution. Please fill us in on what the Senate did and where that particular maneuver stands in the overall process.
Roughly a month ago, the House of Representatives passed their budget resolution, which would allow for a $4.5 trillion tax cut and also allow for about $2 to $2.5 trillion of spending cuts. This was sort of the negotiation that was necessary to get that bill through the House of Representatives. And in order to unlock the sort of golden key for reconciliation and to pass the tax cuts, you have to have a concurrent budget resolution, meaning the same budget has to pass the House and then the Senate. Well, the House's resolution did not include what are known as budget reconciliation instructions for the Senate committees. So we knew the Senate was going to pass a different budget and send it back to the House. And that negotiation took several weeks. And ultimately, last Friday, the United States Senate Republicans, for the most part, got together and passed a resolution. I think it was 51-48 with Patty Murray from Washington State missing the vote. And Susan Collins and Rand Paul, strange political frenemies or whatever you would say, from the far right all the way to the sort of the middle of the entire United States Senate and the left of the Republican Conference. Those two voted against it, but for very, very different reasons. With Senator Paul, I think it's clear that he is opposed to setting the stage for the biggest debt limit increase in our nation's history. This budget resolution would have a lot of pro-growth things, not just on tax policy, but energy and deregulation and, really trying to set the tempo for another economic boom underneath President Trump. And so, Trump wants to have that debt limit increase included. Rand voted against the resolution for that reason. And then Susan Collins wanted to take steps to basically carve out Medicaid and protect Medicaid. And there was a budget resolution amendment that was defeated. So I think that's why she opposed the resolution. Now what happens is the Senate only included $4 billion of targets for spending reductions. And that should be known as a floor, not a ceiling. The Senate was using messaging to say that they want flexibility in allowing the committees to really go as far as they can get, but they don't want to violate the Byrd rule by setting a big target of, let's say $2 trillion for the Senate Finance Committee and then failing to be able to do that. That would kill the whole bill if they can't meet those reconciliation instructions. The Byrd rule, as a reminder to the listeners, is basically the referee that and the rule book for how to adjudicate reconciliation legislation, and the Senate parliamentarian enforces that when various points of order are raised by the party in opposition. And I think that the Senate resolution and having those really, really low spending targets, that's a problem for a lot of conservatives in the House of Representatives. But what I think can start to occur now is a real negotiation on various elements of the tax plan.
So what now is the timing on all of this, Scott? At what point are we targeting or looking forward to getting the final bill and getting a vote that gets this over the finish line?
It's a good question. And, Lohman, I think that there just isn't this urgency in Washington, D.C. to pass a tax plan next week or even in the next few weeks. And that's because there's no real deadline in place. The next big deadline will be the so-called X date on the debt limit. There will be action that's necessary there. But I think that there's some members that say, you can do whatever you got to do on the debt limit. Maybe there ends up being a bipartisan agreement to raise that. But taxes don't actually expire until the end of 2025. And you might remember in 2017 when we did the tax law, we didn't sign that. President Trump didn't sign that into law until the middle of December, right before Christmas. Until there's a real urgency in Washington, D.C., you know, we can have goals and we can continue to work forward. And maybe the middle of June is a good target. Maybe the end of July, right before the August recess. But I really think that it is absolutely critical to getting a bill done as fast as possible so that the economic impact is felt ahead of the 2026 midterms.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, typically you tell us a bit about the club. Let's do that now.
Well, Club for Growth is united in the idea of economic freedom, liberty, opportunity. We want to keep your taxes low. If you want to learn more about where we stand, visit us at clubforgrowth.org, where you can sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, looking forward to talking with you next week. Thank you.
You're welcome.
As the reconciliation process moves forward, the growing national debt will continue to be an issue. For more, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine and Romina Boccia from the Cato Institute.
It may have fallen off the radar a bit this week because of all the other political and economic news, mostly surrounding the president's tariffs and trade war. But we are once again at the beginning of the federal budget cycle, and the Senate is starting to work on a new budget resolution that will set the blueprint for President Donald Trump's first official budget plan that should get through Congress sometime later this year. But that latest budget resolution, according to my guest today, is a fiscal train wreck. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Romina Boccia. She is the director of budget and entitlement policy at the Cato Institute, and she's also the author of The Debt Dispatch, which is a Substack. And if you're not subscribing to that, honestly, you're missing out because she does a tremendous job of following all of the fiscal news in and around the federal government, much of it which will have big implications for you this year as not just the federal budget, but a huge federal tax bill makes its way through Congress. Romina joins us on the phone now, taking some time out of her busy schedule. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Eric.
Really glad to have you here, Romina. Now, look, just about a month ago, Trump stood in front of a joint session of Congress, and he said at one point that he was going to balance the federal budget. I've seen this Senate budget resolution, and it doesn't look like it's going to be balanced, not this year and not anytime soon.
No, far from it. In fact, spending is higher this fiscal year than it was last fiscal year before President Trump took office. And if the uncertainty continues in the markets with the tariffs that President Trump has imposed, which is already raising bond yields on U.S. Treasury bonds, we could be spending even more by the end of this fiscal year as interest costs rise, which will not just affect the United States government's balance sheet, but will also put pressure again on mortgages, car loans, and credit cards and other business loans.
For those of us who don't follow all of this stuff as closely as you do, Romina, I mean, this is very much the first step in what is a long process. It's always weeks, months to get the budget all the way through Congress. Oftentimes, it doesn't get all the way through. We usually end up with some sort of rushed vote, typically like the week before Christmas. How much, you know, how similar do you think whatever the final product is this year, you know, how much similarity will that bear to where we are here with this initial kind of budget blueprint that the Senate has been working on this week?
Yeah, so this is the plan. The budget resolution basically sets the guidelines through which reconciliation shall proceed. So this is really an important document that sets the stage for what will follow, which is why House Republicans are fighting the Senate on this plan right now, because what we're looking at would be a massive $5.8 trillion deficit increase if the Senate plan proceeds, whereas the House plan called for at least $2 trillion in spending reductions and also a smaller tax cut from extending the Trump tax cuts, where the total deficit increase under the House plan will be more like $2.8 trillion. So you're looking at a difference of about $3 trillion, which is significant between the two plans. I think you already picked up on the fact that neither plan proposes to reduce the deficit. So we're really fighting over how much to increase the deficit. And this is going on right now. We're also likely going to see reconciliation move by August because the U.S. debt limit looms. We don't know exactly when, but with the way that markets are going, it might hit us sooner rather than later. The Congressional Budget Office initially projected that we would hit the debt limit in the early fall, perhaps in September or October, but now with interest rates rising again, it is possible that we'll hit the debt limit sooner in June or July, and then of course you have the August recess looming. So rather than a Christmas tree bill at the end of the year, we may be seeing this reconciliation package extending the Trump tax cuts. And then depending on whether we go with the House or Senate version, also advancing some spending reductions or not, move this early summer.
Romina, just a few minutes left here before we let you go. I want to ask about something that you touched on in that Substack post and also earlier in our conversation here, which is these the tax cut extension that Republicans and President Trump want to get through this year, extending the 2017 tax cuts. That is going to that is a big fiscal cost on the budget, and relative to that, the spending cuts that they've proposed as offsets are quite minuscule. So take us through that dynamic and how that's going to really influence the process going forward here.
Yes, the fight right now is whether to stick to the House plan, which calls for a $2 trillion spending cut target, or whether to go with the Senate plan, which has only instructions for about $4 billion in spending reductions, which is like a fraction of a percent of the U.S. federal budget and absolutely not meaningful. You might as well call them zero. In fact, we have a chart up on the debt dispatch that's also on cato.org that shows that compared with the tax cuts that the Senate is calling for of $5.3 trillion in tax cuts, both the Trump tax cut extension and additional new tax cuts that the Senate wants to make space for. They also want to increase spending by another $500 billion, mainly on immigration and defense. And then the $4 billion in spending cuts that they're calling for, they're not even visible on our chart. There's like a tiny little line for the spending reduction, so it's basically zero.
It was actually that chart, exactly that one, that inspired me to reach out to you and ask you to come on the program here, Romina. So thank you for highlighting that. We are unfortunately out of time, though. Once again, that is Romina Baccia from the Cato Institute and the Debt Dispatch on Substack. Romina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And once again, that is Romina Baccia. She is the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute, and find her work as well at Substack. Look for the Debt Dispatch on Substack, where she follows all of the goings-ons with fiscal policy in the federal government. Really important stuff that she follows there and that we are, of course, following as well at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A major political realignment is taking place as a result of President Donald Trump's trade policies. So says Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Donald Trump's trade policies are creating quite the uproar. They are also creating a political realignment. The history of America's two dominant political parties on trade is quite complex. In recent times, Republicans largely favored free trade. On the left, liberals tend to be more free trade than traditional Democrats who are committed to their union base. As for tariffs, look at the two most recent Democrat presidents. Barack Obama slapped a 35% tariff on Chinese tires, and Joe Biden imposed a 25% tariff on Chinese steel and aluminum. Both Biden and his Republican successor, Donald Trump, opposed Nippon Steel's acquisition of Pittsburgh's USX. Last year, I did a commentary on the growing bipartisan opposition to the U.S. steel deal. which included Republican Senators J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, and Josh Hawley, and Democrat Senators John Fetterman, Sherrod Brown, and Joe Manchin. Generally, on the political right, we're seeing sharp splits among Republicans over Trump's tariffs. Scott McKay at the American Spectator consistently urges observers to realize that Trump's tariffs are being done on a reciprocal country-by-country basis. And this isn't just about tariffs. In fact, consider the words of Peter Navarro, who is President Trump's senior counsel for trade and manufacturing. Navarro says, quote, "Take any given country. They all cheat us in a different way. Some engage in currency manipulation. Some, a heavy, hefty VAT tax. All of them dump into our markets. All engage in heavy export subsidies. They put up phony barriers to our agricultural products, our autos, and everything in between. Many of them steal our intellectual property. A lot of them run sweatshop labor, including forced child labor." Says Navarro, quote, "We want fairness. We don't want them to kill American workers with non-tariff cheating," unquote. Indeed. In fact, non-tariff barriers can be worse than tariffs and harder to handle. They're messier. But there's more to the Trump thinking. As Francis Sempa writes at Real Clear Politics, Trump's tariffs are part of an overall America First strategy to promote manufacturing and reindustrialization at home, especially in Rust Belt areas and states like my home state of Pennsylvania. Indeed, making the case for tariffs in the Wall Street Journal, John Michelson, the chief investment officer of Michelson Capital Partners, stated, quote, "Perhaps the worst part of America's free trade policies is their legacy of deindustrialization. Swaths of the country once proud of producing steel and aircraft are now better known for opioid abuse," unquote. Precisely. In fact, that point was made last Saturday morning at the annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference in Harrisburg. Every spring, I personally participate in the breakfast panel at the conference. The moderator is Colin Hanna, and the panelists are myself and the wonderful pundits John Gizzi and Jeffrey Lord. A key point of our discussion was that Trump's economic policies continue to push the working middle class toward the GOP. The Democrats are no longer the party of steelworkers and coal miners, but instead of Starbucks baristas and college professors. Not of Pittsburgh and the Rust Belt, but of Manhattan and Silicon Valley. Not of farmers in the Midwest, but of leftist elites in the Northeast. The effect of Trump's economic policies on Pennsylvania has been politically profound. Christopher Nicholas wrote a very revealing piece of Real Clear Politics titled, "PAGOP Obliterates Democrats' Voter Registration Edge." Nicholas notes that in the early 2000s, there were 500,000 more registered Democrats in the state of Pennsylvania than Republicans. By the time of the Obama years, that Democrat lead doubled to over 1 million. And suddenly, under Donald Trump, that lead has vanished. The Democrat advantage in Pennsylvania is now less than 50,000. The lone Democrat stronghold in the state of Pennsylvania is the Philadelphia media market. Support for Donald Trump has surged in this Rust Belt area of the state. And that's been true in other swing states, Ohio, Wisconsin, etc. The data confirms that Donald Trump's policies are promoting a major voter realignment in many regions. And his likely successors, J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio, are on board with those policies. But alas, the point I've made here in this commentary has been largely political. More important is whether Donald Trump's trade policies will help or hurt the overall economy long term. For me, this longtime free trader, that remains to be seen, as it does for the entire country. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.